Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk about when a COLA is not a COLA. Okay, and to lead us into that discussion is Bob Braunstein, guest co-host today. That really was a Coke can.
It sure was. Boy, that, you're either that or you do a great job with sound effects on your own.
No, that's courtesy of the ever-efficient Andrew, our engineer. Anyway, Bob Braunstein, retired Fed, fellow seminar presenter, guest co-host today, and flew up here from Florida.
Yeah, I flew out of Tampa yesterday, ahead of the storm. My daughter is flying into Miami today after the storm, and my wife is hunkered down in the Tampa area with the storm. So, you know, guess who's having a good time?
Hope she's not listening.
Yeah, she's going to be listening, as a matter of fact.
Judy, this is really rough here.
It's true.
Anyway, so, Bob, when is a COLA not a COLA? How is a COLA, thanks to you and your advanced prep? I actually learned an awful lot from your outline, but let's just start with the basic. What is a COLA and who gets a COLA?
Well, COLAs are cost of living allowances, and they go to retirees. And one of the reasons that I felt this was kind of an interesting topic for the show is that when I teach seminars for NITP, I talk to employees who think they're getting COLAs, and they're really not. They're getting pay comparability adjustments, which feel like COLAs, but they're really based on entirely different things, different indexes and so on.
Okay, let me make sure I understand, because I'm not so sure I totally understood it before I prepped for you coming. Mm-hmm. An employee doesn't necessarily or doesn't get a COLA. Their pay increase is based on some other calculation we'll talk about in a minute.
Yes.
Whereas a retiree does not get that, but they do get a COLA based on some type of cost of living allowance.
That's correct. You got it.
Okay. So let's take a look at the employee right now, because I had an interesting discussion, a very nice group last week. And one of the people said, well, you know, we haven't gotten a salary increase in a couple years. And I said, well, nor have I. But we both have jobs. And you know, it was very kind. He looked at me and go, But I didn't know they didn't get COLAs. I thought their COLA was effectively what you call it for an employee. It's not a COLA.
It's really called a pay comparability adjustment in the technical sense. It goes all the way back to the Federal Pay Comparability Act of 1990, and it's abbreviated FEPCA. You've probably heard this before. It was an attempt to pass pay reform and essentially keep federal pay reasonably close to parity with private sector pay for similar types of work. The guidelines were put into place. Problems along the way as far as whether or not that's actually happened is the fact that, you know, the president has the authority to recommend alternative pay plans, particularly when federal budgetary needs require them. So the formula itself, the pay council, and what they recommend is not necessarily always implemented. Sometimes it's not. And ergo the freeze of the last couple of years, and that was done for austerity measures, et cetera.
Okay, let me ask you a question, but first I'll throw out the phone number because I think people should take advantage of your knowledge base here. 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. Today is August 27th. It's about 10 after 10 a.m. We'll be here for close to another 50 minutes, but don't call us after that time. We'll give you the email address a little bit. Again, 202-465-3080. So here comes this compatible pay index. So it was to say, gee, prior to this date, if you work for Uncle, you maybe were not paid as much as what your counterpart in private industry was. So this was designed then to keep a parallel between the two.
Pretty close, anyway.
All right. So you can't get exact because, you know, does an engineer here make it what an engineer there does? And it all depends on the profitability of the company or the unprofitability of the company. I don't think it's ever gone down. And that brings to mind now, in today's environment, the outside world isn't in a robust hiring mood. And in fact, people have been furloughed. They've had pay cuts rather than be let go and whatnot. But the federal staff does not. does the comparability pay index still look at what, I'll just pick an engineer. An engineer makes in the private sector, even in today's rough environment, does it take into consideration the downsizing and does it take into consideration furloughs or does it just look at, okay, this is what an engineer makes? And
I can't imagine that it wouldn't. You know, I don't know for sure. All I can suggest, though, is that the law itself was designed to keep wages competitive between federal employees and wages paid by firms in the private sector. Now, you know, so if you have somebody who's been furloughed or whatever, I guess you'd focus on the jobs that are still out there being paid.
I would think they would look at, okay, an engineer after 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, it makes X, and they have some kind of algorithm to figure out what
yes.
that is for private industry. And it can't take into consideration furloughs or layoffs. It can't because we don't have them here. In the federal side, we don't have much anyway, and like we do on. So I got to figure it's a parallel.
I think you're right. And if there's somewhat of a deceleration of pay increases in the private sector, that's going to be taken into account. Actually, the index that FEPCA uses is designed to lag by about half a percentage point. There's also a 15-month lag between the time the actual formula is done and when it actually takes place with respect to federal pay, when in fact, you know, it's being followed to the letter. Of course, in the past couple of years, you know, the president has exercised his authority not to grant a raise for the federal government. And this doesn't even take into account the locality component, which has to do with the geographic costs of labor.
And then do they also look at a target market? Like they might look at the intelligence community or they might look at the computer community and say, listen, this is what it is, but in order to get these people, do they have leeway to bring somebody in at a higher grade level because they have this particular skill, but maybe they don't have the years?
Well, the government, for example, does have what we call special pay for recruitment and retention purposes. And these aren't bonuses. These are actually higher salaries paid to professionals like scientists, doctors. I mean, NIH has them, NASA has them. Quite frankly, these folks wouldn't come to work for the government if we didn't pay them more, and we have to pay them more to keep them. So there is latitude. It isn't the broadest latitude, but these folks technically are housed in the same grade structure, but they're paid at a higher level of pay. The same thing existed for information technology folks for a while, you know, when there was a tremendous premium on those jobs and to get people to stay, and we were competing with the private sector.
Okay, then let's say that I work for you, and I'm just going to beat engineers to death, which I'm not. Right? and I'm an engineer, and you're my boss, and I'm going to say, Bob, I appreciate what they did under this comparability or compatibility, but you know I've worked a little harder than I think most of my peers. Can you do something for me? So as a manager, do you have the ability to say, okay, they're going to get this based on the index, but can you bump up somebody over and above that?
You can. I mean, let's focus on the general schedule. There are many pay systems out there, but the general schedule has, in addition to the within-grade increase, which is a longevity-based increase, still designed to compensate you when you're doing a good job. I mean, you're supposed to be. It has merit. It's not just longevity, but you can do the same outside of the time limits associated with those raises with something called a quality step increase, which is essentially the same bump in pay outside of the scheduling of a within grade to recognize a rather remarkable year of achievement. It's usually a good year. Managers also have the opportunity to provide bonuses or lump sum type awards for unique one-off type projects. They call them special act and achievement awards. The executive corps of the government gets bonuses each year. There's a certain amount of their pay that's technically at risk, and they're able to do that. So there are ways of differentiating. I think the challenge, or I should say the frustration among many folks, is that you have a lot of managers who buy into that and use those tools extremely well, and others who are, for whatever reasons, you know, reticent to do it or just simply don't use them as frequently. And then, of course, there are folks who feel that they should get one when their coworker does, and you know, there's concern and angst about that too. But there is latitude, you know, there are opportunities to go beyond the fact that federal pay in general has been frozen. There are way, there are promotions, there are within grades, there are quality step increases. There are a whole variety of things you can do.
Okay, so you have that ability. Then let's say that I feel I should be a GS one notch up from whatever I am. How do I convince you of that, or how do you convince your supervisors of that?
That's a tough thing to do. I mean, that's a classification issue. I was in classification for a while, but what it boils down to is generally you're at your assigned grade because the level of work that you do is lines up with the characteristics of similar work across a whole variety of different occupational categories. The level of difficulty, et cetera, has got you at this particular level. To get beyond that level, you need to move to the next tier. It literally would require a reclassification of your duties to assume more technically responsible work or higher levels of managerial work. It could very well be, though, that you bring unique skills to the job to the point where you make the job more than it is. Years ago, they called that an impact situation, impact of the person on the job, and it still exists. These are difficult. I mean, they're decisions that a manager would have to take to the HR office, make a case for it, and they have to be looked at very carefully because they could have an overarching impact and definite effect on other organizations. And you worry about grade creep. That's one of the big things that HR offices worry about, and they should. Which is why classifiers are not the most popular people in the world. They look at, you know, what people do, and people push back and say, well, you don't know what I do. You don't even understand anything about my technical, guess. But there's a way of looking at it generically, and this is what we do. And it's a tough science, but there are ways of doing it. That's probably the most difficult way.
Now, on the private side, I'm not so sure it's any different. As you probably know, I'm an accountant.
I knew that.
And I gravitate towards taxes, but also get into the management side. And you have the same thing. Somebody will call up and say, listen, my best engineer wants a $5,000 raise. What do you think? And I go, well, you know, how are we going to make up for that? Because margins aren't what they used to be, but you need to keep them. And it's probably better to pay them the extra $5,000. And if you are going to whittle down somebody, whittle down the less productive.
Sure.
So it's the same thing, but they have more of a latitude to raise and cut people back than what they do in the government. But it's no different.
I'm sure it isn't.
Yeah. All righty, so that's it. And again, prior to when you were good enough to send this to me in advance, I always thought the Fed employee got some type of COLA, but it's not.
It's technically called the Employment Cost Index, and it's built around what we've been talking about right now. That the COLA that retirees get, you know, there's a salient difference between the two. The COLA is designed to keep retirees at parity so that they don't lose purchasing power to inflation. The FEPCA raise, or the pay comparability adjustment, is really designed to take into account worker productivity and increases in worker productivity that drive wages up. And the government, through FEPCA, essentially mirrors that and raises the structure to take that into account. They're two totally different principles at hand here. Actually, the COLAs for federal retirees have been around since 1962, and they didn't begin to affect Social Security retirees until 1973. FEPCA has really only been around since 1990, and the question is, has it worked? You know, I found some rather sobering statistics in a Congressional Research Service report that I was reading, and you probably saw the same things. You
know, while you're looking for that,
sure.
Those are pretty neat examples. What does FEPCA stand for again?
It stands for Federal Employee Pay Comparability Act.
Okay.
I think that's what it stands for.
Let me just double it. You know, FERCA, FEPCA?
FEPCA, yeah. I believe that's, or Federal Pay Comparability Act.
Okay.
You know, it's funny. You caught me on that.
And, I'd be 100% sure that I'm right. The only time I ever catch you. So I'm going to write down today and the date. So tell me about those percentages. Those percentages were...
that's what it stands for. I just looked it up.
Very impressive.
They're employees.
Okay. So give us those percentages, how much compensation and or Social Security has risen since these things have been in effect.
Well, interestingly enough, as far as retirees are concerned, at the year end of 2009, the price level as measured by the Consumer Price Index, which is the variable for determining the COLA, and we'll chat about that in a second, it was 477% higher than it was in 1969, meaning that if you had been retired since then, your retired pay has gone up that much by virtue of the COLAs. Social Security benefits are up by 626% since 1969. Now, federal retirement and civil service benefits have gone up by 496%. The other thing is that the salaries for civilian federal employees, by virtue of a totally different index, the Employment Cost Index, is up 428% since 1969, which sounds great, but if you look at comparable civilian sector jobs based on this same report, they're up 625%. So FEPCA is working, but there is still some lag, largely due to the fact that it's not a perfect system. It doesn't operate independently. There are other things in play, and the executive branch definitely has an influence on how much they're going to do in some years.
So it isn't an automatic. The executive branch can say, well, half of that or maybe none of that.
The president has the authority to do that.
Okay.
And is doing it right now.
All right. So let's go to the COLA then that would be of greater interest to the retiree.
Right.
Now, COLAs, over the years, they got the urban index, and they got this index in the Southwest and the Northeast, and what index do they use?
Right now, they use what's called the CPIW, which is the Consumer Price Index for urban and clerical wage earners in urban areas. And it takes into account a market basket of goods and services. The CPI is tracked each year by the Bureau of Labor Statistics over four quarters. And the third quarter is critical because we take a look at, did the CPI based on these indexes go up over last year's third quarter? And if it did, the announcement to the level that it's gone up is generally made late September. It becomes effective on December 1st for retirees, people who are getting retired wages, and they see the first raise in their January check. The key is you got to be retired. You can't be retiring because then you're not eligible for that raise. You haven't been retired. But that's what the CPIW does. Now, what the government has been, or I should say, what's been proposed is a shift in this index to something called the chained index. You may have heard about this, which, loosely put, is an expansion of the goods and services to consider alternative goods that may not have risen that much for inflation. Simplistic example. Kellogg's cornflakes went up 4% this year, but brand Y only went up 2% and brand X didn't go up at all. It's wrong to say that there's 4% inflation by virtue of Kellogg's. So we need to sort of mix those other goods and services into the picture. And that is actually going to put some downward pressure on whatever the COLA would ultimately be, because it's taking into account goods and services that didn't experience the same level of inflation or none at all, perhaps.
And the way they measure it, too, they started off at whatever the year was, and the base was 100.
Right.
And then after that year, if it went up 2%, then the index was 102. But that sets the stage for year three, because they use 102 in the increase over that, and then they figure out the percentage. I remember years ago, when I had to do pay raises for the folks that I work with, I had to get that, I hate to say it, but computers weren't there. And I had this hotline number into the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and I could just call and I could get whatever I wanted. And then, or I could ask them to mail me something. And then eventually this marvelous thing called the fax came into being, and I could get stuff faxed. I'm dating myself, but I don't think...
Thermofax.
Thermofax. And mimeograph machines.
Oh, anyway. There you go.
But what I'm saying is you just couldn't get it that easily.
Right.
And now it's cake to get. And so what I'm saying to the people listening, you can kind of look at this to get a better appreciation of it other than saying, oh, this is too small or this is why. But this will show you that it isn't necessarily the government trying to be too kind, not kind at all, or gentle.
I have a couple of bookmark pages, actually, on my computer, you know, tracking the CPI, so I can always see kind of where it is. But it's interesting. That third quarter is critical because if you get a spike in gas prices in that third quarter, that's going to have a big influence. If it's conversely, if it's going to go down, and we never know what's going to happen with gas, that's a major influence that could cause the coal to go down.
And third quarter does go up.
Sure.
Because second quarter would end in June, and it seems for whatever magical reason, gas prices tend to go up. I won't say always go up, but tend to go up about that time.
Yeah, and one of the ways I talk to folks in the seminars, I say, well, you know you're not getting a COLA, and why? Because last year, and I'm a federal retiree, I got a 3.6% COLA. What did you get across the board? The answer is, well, we didn't get anything because pay is frozen. Well, that should give you an indication right there that we're dealing with totally separate indexes, different ways of looking at things. I mean, the federal, the COLA for retirees, conversely, in the past 2 years was a goose egg because the CPI did not go up. And actually, this raise from last year was measuring against the last year that there was any raise in the CPI, which is all the way back to 2008. So it took that long for another COLA to happen. So it's complex. There are a lot of moving parts. And the Employment Cost Index, which also is tracked by the Bureau of Labor and Statistics and also works on a quarter system, looks at entirely different variables.
Okay, so when some people talk about the high five or the high three, so the high three in today's world may not be any different.
Yeah, I mean, for those who are sitting at what we call asterisk salary levels or who might have been affected by the freeze to the point where they're not seeing any increase at all, they're topped out, I always suggest to them, take a look at where you sit now. I mean, you may still have some lower rates of pay within your current three-year period. If you sit at your current level of pay and retire 3 years from now, those lower rates are going to drop off. You're looking at literally 3.000 times whatever your salary is. So your high three is going to be higher. I guess what you have to ask yourself is if because my high three is not going to go up anymore, or maybe it's going to be a high five, are these necessarily showstoppers? How could one, if we went to a high five, which isn't really going to affect the current workforce based on everything I'm reading, what would that mean? Well, it means we're going to average in a couple of lower years of pay. Well, what could I do to offset that if I was worried about my retirement benefit? And the answer is, well, work another 2 or 3 months. Or maybe it's not a big deal. Maybe it's just not going to make a huge difference if you truly are ready to go, have other things to do. Are these showstoppers? Are they that painful financially? And quite frankly, it really isn't. It doesn't make a huge difference.
Okay.
Yeah. A few hundred bucks.
We did a show on that but when the high five first started to become more of a conversation piece than what it was in the past. And we probably shouldn't go that far into it today.
It's been around forever. When I first started working for the government, they'd just gone to a high three, and they've been talking high five ever since. And it could happen again. I believe it probably won't be implemented other than for newer folks next year or people returning with less than 5 years of service.
All righty, so then our advice to our listeners would be perform admirably and bring that up at review time.
Absolutely. And, you know, the other thing to think about, too, is if you're content, if you like your job, you know, retirement planning is an important thing. And getting your benefit to be as high as possible is a goal that we all have. What it boils down to is if you're really not ready to retire, are some of these things that might inhibit what you perceive would be a bigger benefit, are those the reasons to stop working? Have you planned? Or do you really even know what you're going to do? It's important to know that first. And you've said this to me on numerous occasions. You've got to cost out what your retirement lifestyle is going to be. So is it really going to have that dramatic an impact on the resources you need when you're no longer a federal employee? You need to know what you need to have, and it could be you may have more than enough. These things may be nothing more than noise.
Right, and in class recently, I do primarily pre-retirement. I don't do many mid-career, but I was in one the other day, and easily half the class was not over 35.
Wow.
And I've noticed that more and more over the last few years. Sometimes it's just two or three, but, I mean, clearly they're 25 or 28. And I go up and ask, and I've said this on air before, and it's just very interesting to me, almost to the person. They say, I don't want to mess up, and I want to know now. So, you know, that younger person certainly is going to be FERS, and it's a mixed group, so there might be a little animosity with the CSRS, but it's not the CSRS person's fault. They just hired on at that time. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like buying stock. You know, if we had bought Apple way back when, we'd be happy campers buying it now. You guys say, how much more can it go up? Don't ever take my advice on buying stock, but it's somewhat the same analogy. So I'll talk to the younger people, and I said, you know, some of this you need to know to project out. Some of the things with regards to tax law is certainly going to change 1, 2, 3, 4 times before you retire, but the basics aren't. You need a certain amount of money to live on when you retire, because you're FERS, you've got this three-legged stool, but be careful how you use those legs. And I'll bring that up in class. You know, should I buy an annuity with my FERS? Depends on interest rates at the time, and depends on your age at the time. Interest rates right now are not particularly high. I didn't say annuities are bad, but you know, just be aware of what you're buying. It's not based on years in service and highest compensation like the federal government annuity.
It's not a high watermark variable either.
No. And, you know, people go, oh, what's the difference between an annuity and a pension? And a pension might be, and they don't get pensions, they get annuities, which are the better things. It's a promise by uncle to pay them for the rest of their life based on years in service and their highest compensation. But it's a promise for life, and it does get some adjustment for a COLA, assuming that there's going to be a return to some type of a COLA. A pension, on the other hand, is... been nice knowing you, Bob. We're going to pay you $467.27 for the rest of your life. And you go, what about the cost of living? You're on your own. But it was really nice having you here for the last 35 years.
It's a big difference. You know, it's good that you brought that up, too, because people in FERS need to understand. And you were talking about the three-legged stool. Some of them tend to look with tunnel vision at the defined benefit they have, the annuity they have, looking at it as being half the size, roughly, of what a CSRS person makes. But what they also need to understand, and I remind them, is they're paying less than 1% in most cases of their income to fund that benefit. The government's putting a lot more into that pot. CSRS folks, this was their lifeboat long before FERS, long before TSP. That's what they took into retirement. They didn't qualify for Social Security because the work they do is not FICA taxed. And they're paying 7% of income every 2 weeks into that pot. So if you look at a FERS pension, which is about half the size of a CSRS pension in most situations, and you're paying less than 1%, you're getting four times the bang for the buck. Not to mention that all of the work you do under FERS, in addition to other work that you might have done outside of government, is going to be in the Social Security system, so there's a benefit coming from that. Your challenge, as I'm sure you've talked to folks, is to make that third leg, that TSP, make up the difference, you know, to get that 35 or 40% out of that so that you can really live larger. That's the key. The other thing I thought was worth mentioning, and it's actually part of the research I did, is, you know, we talked about COLAs. The COLAs for retirees and FERS are different than they are for CSRS. The major difference with respect to the annuity in FERS goes back to the fact that that defined benefit was diminished somewhat when FERS was created.
Okay, I'm going to stop you
okay,
here because
you're glazing over.
No. I'm absorbing, but some people might not understand defined benefit.
You're right. Term of art.
Only it's the same thing as what we're talking about with the FERS and the CSRS annuity, but you probably would be much more eloquent than me in explaining what a defined benefit
is. It means that you don't really have any choice. If you look at your pay stub every 2 weeks, there's a certain amount that gets put into a pot, and it's called retirement. And for FERS people, it's their FERS contribution. For CSRS, it's CSRS. You can't choose the amount. It's your funding, your share of the funding that goes into this civil service retirement and disability fund that's going to pay your annuity when you're eligible to retire. It's defined by law, and you have no choice. You pay for it if your job is covered by a retirement plan.
Having no choice in a defined benefit plan is much better than having a choice and not having a defined benefit plan.
Correct.
So for those listening, a defined benefit is a jazzy way to say it's a guarantee that you're going to get X dollars for the rest of your life. And in the case of the federal worker, with a COLA.
Right.
Maybe occasionally. Whereas in the other side of the fence, and I'm not trying to play the violin for the private industry, but there are less and less firms offering defined benefit plans because it's so expensive. A certain amount of money has to be set aside to fund that. And I was just reading some publication this weekend about the most healthy states. And one of the factors that they look for was the unfunded defined benefit plan for state workers, be it law enforcement or be it, if they will, their counterpart civil servant. And they were behind because they couldn't afford to put the money away, because under pension rules, you have to put the money away because the money has to pay the person's guaranteed defined benefit. Whereas if there isn't that, they don't have to put any money away. Whatever's in the pot is theirs. That's it.
Right.
Okay. Sorry to get off on the trail,
but
people go, huh?
Yeah, and again, the FERS defined benefit, to use that term, is going to be a smaller one, but for a lesser contribution. And it has different rules regarding these COLAs that we're talking about. You know, there are some exceptions, but by and large, the general population under FERS will not see a COLA until they're eligible for Social Security, assuming they've retired at what they call minimum retirement age, or later 56, 57, whatever the case might be. They don't see COLAs until generally age 62. And then the COLA itself is indexed somewhat differently. It's not going to be the same as the Social Security COLA. It would be the same if the COLA were 2% or less. But once the COLA starts to rise, say between 2 and 3%, the first COLA would be capped at 2%, if the COLA was between 2 and 3%. And if it goes above 3%, it's generally the COLA for FERS minus 1. Last year, we had a 3.6% Social Security COLA, and for CSRS, it was 3.6. But for the FERS annuity people, it would be 2.6. Their Social Security would get 3.6, but it's a downward adjustment. Once again, taking into account that that's not where the government put most of its money when it designed FERS.
Is that what we started off with the popping of the can, the Diet Cola?
The Diet Cola. That was a Diet Cola. I saw that.
Well, Andrew,
they call them Diet Colas.
Andrew, the engineer that makes this show hum, was kind enough to bring in that sound effect because I was forgetful enough to forget it. Thank you, Andrew. But actually, I think this is high test, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Now, there are exceptions to that rule.
So we got a CSRS can.
FERS COLAs remain diet, but there are people who get them, you know, they're eligible for them immediately. People who retire under disability, people who retire in occupational categories that have mandatory age separation, like firefighters, law enforcement officers, air traffic controllers. Their COLAs are immediate, but they still follow the FERS diet COLA rules.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question.
Sure.
And I know you're going to knock the cover off the ball, but this came out in that same seminar. It was a small group, but they came from disciplines and they had really good questions. One lady, and it's not an uncommon question, and I would always follow your subject, whether it's you or one of the other speakers, because it doesn't make sense to start off with income taxes. So we were talking about timing of retirement, but when I do that, I try to bring in what you talk about, benefits, and what the finance person talks about, finance, and then tax, and to say, with those three things in mind, ignoring psychology, emotion, and birth dates, not that legal isn't important, not that health isn't important, not that psychology, but I only understand those three. Mm-hmm. And you know, I asked the people in the room, and invariably it starts off December 31st, January 1st, 2nd, or 3rd, and then somebody else will say some other date. But there was one question, and it's fairly often, and you can better explain this than I, and somebody says, no, I'm going to go out in the middle of January, so if there's a COLA, my annuity will increase.
See, that's the misconception. Should I retire because now there is going to be a COLA and federal pay is frozen? And the answer really is no, because you have to be a retiree to get the raise under the COLA formula. If I retire on January 3rd, for example, my first annuity day, if you will, is January 4th. So I'm retired from January 4th until the end of November, November 30th, whereupon the December 1 raise for the COLA, if there is one, would take effect, and I would see it on my retired pay January 1st the following year. The whole point is you've got to be retired. Now, I could retire midway through the year. Let's say I retired October 3rd as a CSRS person. I don't have a lot of annual leave to worry about, so I'm not worried about the carryover or anything like that. I'm leaving on the 3rd of the month so that my annuity will start the next day. That's one of the things in the formula, best day to retire. Well, I'm only retired from October 4th to the end of November for the coming COLA. The COLA would take effect December 1, I'd see it January 1, but it'd be for 2 months. It'd be for 1/6 of what the COLA amount would be. So is that a driving factor for retiring? Not really. The other thing that people worry about, too, is that, well, you know, if there is going to be a pay raise, shouldn't I stick around to get it? Isn't that going to have an effect on my high three? And the answer is, if you're only going to be in that rate of pay for 2 or 3 days, it's going to have minimal impact. But what about my annual leave? That's going to be paid out in a lump sum. If I don't stick around for the raise, isn't my annual leave going to be paid to me at the lower rate? And that's not true either, because it's paid as if used. I've got 400 hours of annual leave. If I was in the government from January 3rd to the point where those 400 hours would expire as an active employee, I'd be working till the end of March. Well, the government says if there is a pay raise and it's effective on January 10th, then your first 7 days or 6 days of retirement is paid at the lower rate, and everything else in your annual leave is paid to you at the higher rate as if you had been here to get the raise. So there are things that you simply need to understand that aren't really driving factors. You know, there may be driving factors to let you just leave early and not worry about some of this stuff and do the things you'd rather be doing.
Yeah, that's actually, I try to get that across in class. And when I asked the class, I mean, close to 100% is December 31st, January 1st, 2nd, or 3rd, the initial response. But then somebody else will go, no, mine is the end of September. No, mine's May 15th. You know, if it's a FERS person, you go, okay, maybe. If it's a CSRS, I said, well, maybe we'll talk about what you heard the first day during benefits. You might not want to pick that date if you're CSRS or offset.
Right.
So it's a good discussion, but it brings into consideration all the.
I wanted to lean on your tax expertise. Ooh. Just before we go away from this subject. One of the things that I've heard and people ask me about is that I heard in one of these tax presentations by Bob or one of your compatriots that if I, you know, don't really have that much leave to worry about, if I take it upon myself to leave on April 15th, but between January 1 and April 15th, I find a way to pull out of my pay my full TSP contribution, that'll come off my prior tax year. Could you talk about that for a second? Is that true?
Okay. Everything until the last sentence.
Okay. Okay. I knew I was wrong on something.
No, you're never wrong. You hit, and I do it. I really pound on it when I talk about mid-year, but it would work at any time during the year. People that are fortunate enough, and again, this is a pre-retirement class, to be able to put the full amount into the thrift is a substantial amount of money. It's up to what, 22.5?
It's like 900 a pay period,
yeah,
close to it.
It's an awful lot of money. So most people can't write checks for that or don't care to write checks for that because it would really cut down on their savings. So they spread it out evenly during a 26 pay period cycle. Now, when you start talking about mid-year, or like you say, in April, they don't have 26 pay periods, but you can do something, and the term is called front-load the thrift. So you can still maximize your $22,000, depending on your age, or $17,500, whatever it is. If not, by having that amount of money withheld from your pay for that short period of time, be it April, be it June, it doesn't make any difference. Now, somebody says, yes, but that would get in the way of my eating habit. And that would get in the way of me being able to pay my mortgage without question. But at the same time, if that much money was going into the thrift, they're doing themselves maybe a triple favor. One, it's a tax deferral, so it goes into the thrift and it's not taxed until it's taken out. Two, it lowers the taxes, and that's what's key here. If you're not going to pay tax on the full amount of your salary because so much of it's going into the thrift, you reduce your withholding. It frees up the cash. It's crazy to get the refund at the end of the year and starve during that period of time. Now, I'm not saying cause it to be zero, but bring it way down. The earlier you go out, it could be close to zero.
So my question is, if I did that front loading and I got it all in there by the 15th of April, would that technically not come off my prior year's
taxes? No way. because anything that's withheld from the thrift is withheld as you earn it. So
Got
if
it.
You're earning it in the current year, it becomes a deduction in the current year. And an easier way to remember this, all of us as individual taxpayer, with extremely rare exception, we all pay taxes the same way. Calendar year, cash basis.
Got it.
Whatever we get, whatever we don't get is a deduction during that period of time.
So this is different than funding a SEP IRA or something like that on the outside, where in fact you get it in there by the 15th, it comes off your prior year taxes.
An IRA, for anybody listening, is the same thing.
Got it.
If somebody wanted to put money into their 2012 IRA, and whether they could deduct it or not, they can. They can deduct it. They can claim it. But Congress says, well, we'll give you until April 15th of next year to fund the preceding year. But that's just an IRA. That's not the TSP.
Got it. I guess the only way you could really get it in there by April 15th, given that spreading it out during the year is almost $900 a pay period to do the full $22,500, mm-hmm. you'd have to take a bridge loan to live on.
I understand that, but that's usually the comment that they make. And I said, well, there's one thing you can do to soften it, it won't solve it, is to cut your withholding.
True.
Or maybe you're going to have some accumulated leave that's going to get paid out. Take a loan on that. But be very careful. Make sure when you account for what leave you're going to get, you boil the taxes out of it, because the real taxes, not the withholding taxes. And then pay the loan back. Works the same thing for the voluntary contribution.
Is there a threshold of interest that the IRS has when you cut back your withholding? I mean, how many allowances can you claim before they look at you?
Generally, let's call it 13.
Okay.
Now, if you get a note from your parents, you can go above 13. No, I'm not being a wise guy with that. Most of us are not going to get notes from our parents. But if you write kind of not a sob story, but you say, gee, my income is such that normally would be taxed, but because I have such a high mortgage, or I have unfortunately high medical expenses, I'm really not going to have much in taxes, but the payroll folks won't let me go over 13. Now, then, this is, again, a nice theory, they're supposed to attach that letter and send it off to the IRS to explain why. Because otherwise, most people that had no ability to foresee the future would say, I don't want anything withheld. I'll make it up come April 15th. Well, it's almost impossible.
Sure.
Because that person probably is not going to save like most of the rest of us. I'm no different. I can't save that kind of money and pay it once a year.
No, I do quarterly.
Yeah.
Got to.
Okay. So we took a nice segue over to taxes, but taxes are part of this succession of moving parts, the engine of which is benefits.
And I'm always getting questions about taxes. So it's the more I talk to you, the more I learn about them.
Yeah. And usually people bristle. They say, what are we going to do for 3 hours talking about taxes? Well, if you don't understand taxes have a really major influence on cash flow. You're going to pay them. Nobody should cheat, but you don't look to pay as much as you can. You pay the legal minimum that you can. And in the reverse, my wife is going to roll her eyes if she's listening, but if somebody spends a dollar, somebody spends $10, somebody spends $100, they had to pay tax on all that first. So if you figure out what tax bracket it is, and if there's a state, and if there's a Medicare, or if there's Social Security, that could almost be 50% more than what you're paying. Again, if you add all those taxes in plus the sales tax.
Mm-hmm.
And so I learned that a long time ago from an engineer. Engineers are really good managing money. And they say, if you spend a dollar, you're really spending $1.75. And I go, how do you figure that? And I go, duh, this is what I do for a living. And, they mash numbers. Anyway, sorry to get off on that.
That's okay. You saw my eyes glazing over because I didn't know what you were talking about, but that's okay.
In order to get that buck, you had to pay all the taxes up front. Anyway, so let's get back to why we came here to talk about COLAs and UNCOLAs. We have a few minutes left. Gee, nobody's called us. 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. I did mention that after the show, you can email us 24/7, and this show will go up on the net. Andrew is really quick. He writes a great synopsis, and it'll be up at, 2 or 3 this afternoon? YOUR, benefit, as in benefit, at NITPINC.com. For your benefit, at NITPINC.com. You can listen to the show, and You can email us questions. And we don't mind answering questions. Sometimes I know we answer questions for the competition, but that's okay. We're not discriminatory. So it doesn't have to have a government email address, although it should. Anyway, Bob.
Coming full circle. So you're a federal retiree. You're going to get COLAs, whether you're FERS, whether you're CSRS. There are different rules. They take a little bit more time. Social Security folks get COLAs, too. Now, there's one thing we didn't mention yet, which is kind of interesting. Many people become eligible for Social Security at 62. That's an early retirement for Social Security. It's a reduced one. If you wait to what they term full retirement age, it's going to be full. And that's 66 or 67, depending upon when you were born. What's interesting is that when you become eligible for Social Security, which many of us will be age 62, but if you do not draw your benefit yet, you could be working to the point where you're making too much money to get a benefit. Your benefit begins calculation or gets calculated from the time of eligibility. When you draw that first check, when you reach full retirement age, irrespective of the work you might be doing, what's particularly interesting is that if there had been any COLAs along the way, they will be a factor in determining what that first monthly check is. It's not just the fact that you've waited and gained an extra 25 or 30% benefit because it's not reduced. But if, for example, if you're drawing your benefit now in 2012 at 66, full retirement age, you were technically eligible for it 4 years ago. There was a COLA in 2009 and another one last year. So that 5.8 and 3.6 would actually factor into what your first check is going to be. It's interesting. Social Security is a little bit more dynamic. The high three is static when you retire. You have an annuity. It goes up by COLAs. But what's particularly interesting about Social Security is it takes into account the earlier COLAs, even if you didn't receive them, if you wait for your benefit until your full retirement age.
Well, I had this goofy idea as I approached 62. And I said, I don't know whether it was you or Tammy or one of the benefit speakers. And I said, what if I go and apply for it? I'm going to lose it because I'm still working. I won't get any cash flow. But if they do anything to Social Security, will I be grandfathered in? And either as you or Tammy looked at me like, where do you get these questions?
It must have been Tammy, but I'm going to ask you the same question. Where do you get these questions? That's a good one.
Middle of the night, they just come. The spaceship flies over.
You know, in the past, it wasn't uncommon for a person to do that, to apply, knowing full well they wouldn't get any benefits, but they did that so that their non-gainfully employed spouse would be eligible to apply for spouse benefits.
Oh.
You know, you didn't have to be drawing one on your own, but perhaps your spouse who was in the home had reached the age of 62 and was going to draw on a work record. The law says for a spouse to be able to draw on your earnings record, you have to have at least applied for your benefit. So it was not an uncommon thing to do when the working demographic was largely one gainfully employed worker.
Well, that's pretty slick. I didn't know that.
Interesting stuff. Yeah. I didn't either. I kind of find these things out as I go. I found that out about a year ago.
All. Yeah.
So that's, the more we teach, the more we learn.
Okay, now we got, what we got, 4 more minutes, Andrew? Yeah, Andrew says yes. So any kind of crafty ideas we can give our listeners or have them better understand what they've got? Because sometimes I feel there's a little disappointment that the workers haven't received a salary increase.
Well, one of the things I always tell folks is that, you know, they're saying, well, my benefit's not going up. Every day you work, and I'm sure you emphasize this as well, you're getting paid as an active employee. Washington sometimes tends to be in a bit of a bubble. When I left the Washington area and moved to Florida, I saw how depressed economies could be. Now, I'm not being sanctimonious about this. Everybody deserves what they should be getting. But what it boils down to is that if you're enjoying your work, you know, postponing retirement or working an extra 6 months, you get active pay, you're increasing your benefit by a certain percentage. There are ways of sort of going against what seems to be the tidal wave of reduction of benefits, you know, whatever is out there, whatever's being proposed. The other thing I always tell folks, too, is that acts of Congress are necessary to make a lot of the things that they're hearing about actually happen. A high five isn't going to happen until there's a law passed for it. They're not going to make you pay more contributions for your defined annuity benefit until there's a law passed. And then the question is, who's going to be in that population? Don't lose sleep over these things. Enjoy your career while you're enjoying it. if you're positioned and ready emotionally and know what you're going to be doing on the outside, pull the plug when the time comes. Because for every day that you work, it's one less day to be able to do those types of things. But as you've eloquently stated on numerous occasions, you got to sort of practice the lifestyle from a monetary perspective. Do you have enough money to make that happen? And if you don't, if there's a gap, then figure out ways to fill that gap, either by investing differently or maybe even doing some part-time work that you'd really enjoy doing. One of the things that I found when I retired early was that having that defined benefit, the annuity, and my health insurance that I could take with me into retirement gave me tremendous leverage to consider things that I never would have been able to do before from a gainful perspective. I could work contractually. I could work for one employer versus another. I could fire all the other ones and just do all my work for NITP, which is what I do now.
Very good move.
And I've been thrilled.
There's
a lot to live out there. You know, it's a question of getting up and going to do it.
I was
going to
say, you are the poster child for this. I am not.
I appreciate that.
All righty. Well, I guess we are about done, Andrew. Nobody wants to call us, but maybe somebody. No, nobody will call us next week because I believe it's a holiday. All right. And we'll play. I don't know which one we're going to play, but thanks for listening. And we'll be back live the week after Labor Day. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.